The Life of Gustavus Adolphus. Gustav Adolphus and Ebba Brahe, Part 1. In reports of Steinbach and Skeit upon their English mission, there are very plain hints that Gustav Adolf's own will and pleasure might be a decisive factor in the prosecution of negotiations with the House of Stuart. We recall Otto Mourner's words regarding his early awakening interest in a certain of the young women of the court. It's not clear whether Ebba Brahe had been at the time launched into the court society. According to the old tradition, it seems inherently probable Queen Christina took over her upbringing after the death of her mother in the spring of 1611. She was then hardly more than a child, for she had just turned 15. It soon became sufficiently clear that she was the object of Gustav Adolf's knightly devotion. A miniature portrait of Ebba Brahe, dating from a rather earlier period, shows us a soft, amiable face with aristocratic features and large, mild eyes. Her social position was above criticism. According to traditional Swedish ideas, there was no reason, a priori, why a king should not take her as his bride. Her father, Magnus Brahe, Count of Visingborg, was Lord High Steward. In point of rank, he was the first dignitary in the kingdom, and he was also one of the greatest landed proprietors. Both on his father's and his mother's sides, she could claim relationship to the royal family. The old Queen Dowager, the pious widow of Gustav I, was Brahe's aunt, and was still, in spite of her advanced age, managing her estate at Stromstom. And had not King Johan taken his second wife from the Swedish higher nobility? Indeed, there was not still living on a manor somewhere up in Travisland an aging woman who had once worn the crown of a queen, for all that she was only a poor soldier's daughter. At the time of Gustav Adolf's ascension, both Katrina Steinbach and Karin Menn's daughter were still alive. Indeed, the former lived long enough to see his young queen, and incidentally, to give her a handsome wedding present. Karl IX, who was himself a noble of Swedish blood, as pure as of any nobility, whom he summoned to his service, was too much of a realist for all his old-fashioned ideas and some other respects to allow any consideration to influence him other than those of dynastic policy. He had condemned Johann's choice of Gunilla Balki as quite unsuitable, and had pointed his disapproval by absenting him from the wedding. The distinction between a sovereign and a subject must never be suffered to be obscured. He might now and then toy with the idea of a marriage between his daughter Katrina and Maria Elizabeth and his deadly enemies, the Polish Vasa, but certainly he never for one moment entertained the notion that one of his sons wedding a woman from Swedish nobility. Yet both came very near to doing so. For his premature death, Carl Philip had managed to contract a secret morganatic marriage with a young lady named Ribbing. The furtive nature of the connection is no doubt to be explained by the 21-year-old Duke's respect for the strictness and worldly wisdom of his mother. Her capacity for getting her own way in affairs of this sort was a matter of common knowledge, in flat contradiction to current ecclesiastical ideas, which considered the union of cousins to be a thing forbidden. She had, in 1612, brought about the marriage of Johann of Östergötland to Maria Elizabeth, in spite of the fact that the whole body of the clergy had put in an exasperated protest, and in spite of obvious lack of mutual inclination on the part of contracting parties. It was a matter of course that the queen would bring all her obstinacy to bear in order to thwart her eldest son's intention of raising to the throne one of her own ladies-in-waiting. I need to mention something. The term morganatic marriage means that you marry, but you don't have any of the titles. You don't have any of the responsibilities. The poets in popular tradition, too, have delighted to dwell upon Gustav Adolf's youthful love affair. Our only reliable information concerning it is based upon exclusively the correspondence between the two young people, and even that has not been preserved for posterity in its entirety. In the course of the years, 10 of Gustav Adolf's letters and notes to Ebba Brahe have come to light, most of them dated. Of Ebba's letters to the king, only one genuine example remains. With unaffected naturalness, Gustav Adolf lays bare to us his character in these letters, proud, self-confident, impetuous, but at the same time tender, delicate in feeling, imperturbably optimistic under all the harrowing uncertainty of what the future might hold for them. One of the most discerning of our literary critics, Oscar Levertine, has said of his love letters that they are fascinating from a psychological as also from an aesthetic point of view. It is a noble nature that reveals to us a nature in which the utterance of the profoundest emotions can command the style and range of expression which betray the sensitiveness of the poet. There is no mistaking that the genuineness and depth of the passion which Gustav Adolf avowed in those letters to the woman of his heart. This is not the language of a passing infatuation, but reading between the lines, we can see his ardent and passionate temperament was no secret to those who knew him. The love letters to Ebba Brahe also provide a pretty clear picture of the outward course of this youthful episode. His first letter was written early in the spring of 1613, and at the beginning of 1615, the correspondence was broken off under circumstances which are better known to us from other sources. But before the earliest dated letter, we may divine a whole chain of events whose culmination, the king's demand for the hand of his well-beloved, seems to be relatively recent. Probably he had made such declaration at a meeting on the occasion of the celebration of Duke Johann's marriage in the previous November. For when in March 1613, less than 2 months after the conclusion of the peace with Denmark, he repeated his request for an answer. It was impossible that he should not have seen her in the meantime. The new factor in the situation is clearly Magnus Brahe. He had visited his daughter in Nykoping and had been informed of the king's suit. It is immediately after this visit that we learn that she has put the whole matter in the hands of her father. At this stage, however, his attitude is still a matter of uncertainty. So we'll stop here. Now, there's four parts to this, because it's going to take a while to get this straightened out, because the problem is not just her dad, it's Gustavus Adolphus's mother. She is just intransigent over this issue. The sources for this are Gustavus Adolphus versus Wallenstein by Pike, Gustav Adolphus, Sweden and the 30 Years' War, 1630-32, by Volk, The Lion of the North by Henty, Gustav Adolphus the Great by Onlund, and Gustav Adolphus and the Rise of Sweden by Roberts, Gustav Adolphus's Army, Part 1, Infantry by Brzezinski, Gustav Adolphus's Army, Part 2, Cavalry by Brzezinski. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise. If you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.